Hello, everybody, and welcome to the War Room. So we've got a weekend off. We're already a weekend off of UFC fights, so I thought I'd do something a bit more fun. Of course, Francis Ngannou is a free agent. There are lots of good options for him out there, and I thought I'd chat about some of his options today. Obviously, boxing, MMA, you know, champions in different organizations, etc., etc. I've just, you know, it's been kicking around in my head, you know, if I was Francis Ngannou, if I was the baddest man on the planet, who would I want to fight next to prove it? And, you know, where would the biggest challenges and the best paydays be? And obviously, I mean, you know, the biggest paydays are most likely going to be against boxers. But there are still some interesting MMA fights for him out there. Just nothing that's going to validate him like a win over John Jones would, which is where we'll finish the show. Okay, so I'm going to start with boxing. I'm going to start with someone that's called him out, that's asked to fight him in a boxing ring, Derek Chisora. Now, this is fun for a lot of reasons, because I like Derek Chisora a lot. He's one of those guys that he often goes into a fight against someone that, of course, is expected to beat him, and he just has this, like, supreme confidence. But he also has the respect of the reasons why people expect him to be the underdog in the fight. And I think coming into this fight against Ngannou, of course, I mean, you know, he's 40 plus boxing fights in his career, loads of experience, and this is his realm, because we're probably not going to see Derek Chisora, unless the money was, you know, unreasonable. We're not going to see Derek Chisora fight Ngannou in MMA. And again, I don't think, you know, there wouldn't be a draw for that like there would be if it was Tyson Fury, which we'll get on to. Derek Chisora in a boxing match, though, especially if you want to see Ngannou lace up bigger gloves and fight someone in a ring, you know, just to kind of introduce him to the sport of boxing, I don't think Derek Chisora is a bad shout. Now, of course, Chisora would be an absolute nightmare for him, because he's very, very clever at staying safe against big, powerful punchers. I mean, he's relatively undersized for a heavyweight, as you can see here. So he's got a 2-inch height disadvantage and a 9-inch reach disadvantage against Ngannou. But again, you know, the way that Chisora fights, he kind of works his way inside, he comes over the top and he leans on people, he ties them up, he makes it untidy. And against Ngannou, who, if he's stepping into a boxing ring, there's going to be anxiety and excitement, and because he's taken this route and he's vacated the UFC heavyweight title, there's pressure on him now to prove that that was the right decision to make, and also to maintain the wealth and the value of his brand in the combat sports world. Derek Chisora would be one of the lower risk fighters for Ngannou to face that would be worth facing. And now, of course, you can pull in a few other boxers, heavyweights, and, you know, this journeyman and stuff. You could kind of build Ngannou a boxing career before he starts taking some of these fights, of course. But there's also the risk, especially at heavyweight, of one of these guys clipping him or tying him up and wearing him out and showing weaknesses that someone like a Derek Chisora or, of course, a Tyson Fury would really exploit. So it's a very, very difficult decision for Ngannou, where to go and who to fight and what risks to take. Now, because he'd be such a big underdog against Tyson Fury, there'd be no real risk there, because people would be expecting him to step into a boxing ring against the best heavyweight on the planet and, of course, struggle. But I feel like people would look at this fight like, well, you know, he might catch Derek Chisora. Now, Chisora is a tough guy. He's been stopped 4 times. Tyson Fury retired him the first time they fought. The last time he fought Tyson Fury, which was obviously his last fight, was a stoppage as well. 10th round. 10th round? Was it 10th? Yes. And then his other two stoppages, Dillian White in the 11th round and David Hay back in 2012 in the 5th round. That's the quickest stoppage. So you're still looking at, you know, 15 minutes worth of toughness and smarts and good boxing from Derek Chisora before he got caught by David Hay. Against Fury and Dillian White, he was able to push it into, you know, the 30-minute realm, where someone like a Francis Ngannou may really, really be struggling with his gas tank by then. 3-minute rounds, you know, he sits down in between and has a little bit of a breather. So then he comes out in that first 30 seconds feeling recharged. And then, you know, that first 30 seconds becomes the first 20 seconds and 15 seconds until he's starting the round exhausted. And this is where Derek Chisora starts going, double jab to the body, right hand over top, double jab to the body, right hand over the top. And then when he's in close, he's going to frame with this left hand and he's going to hit him with this right hook and right uppercut over and over again. I like Derek Chisora's style because, and as you can see on the bottom of the tail of the tape, I've given all these guys a superpower. Now, righteous determination. I could have given Francis Ngannou, of course, you know, the impact of a Ford Escort or whatever it was, or but it's his determination is what stands out for me for Francis Ngannou. You know, you look back into his life story, the determination to get to where he is right now would have been immense. You know, and there's a lot of character in a lot of these fighters that I've picked out. You know, but that for me is something that stands out about Francis Ngannou. And also, you've got to remember, you know, the righteous determination it takes to make the decision that he's made and stick to his guns and, you know, wander off into the wilderness to see if he can find his worth. It's a very, very brave and risky thing for him to do. And that's why very, very few people have ever had the courage to do it. But that shows a lot of character, and it shows that he's fighting for something bigger than himself, which puts him in a separate class to me. For a lot of people, on the other side, Derek Chisora. I mean, you know, of course, he's a fun character. He's got some great one-liners, and he's a very intense individual. Especially, I mean, you look at the start of the last fight against Tyson Fury. There was a bit of a weird kind of glove touch situation where Chisora was trying to get to him before the fight started, and the referee had to kind of hold him back. He's a real interesting and fiery guy, but you know, you look at his record. Yeah, he's got 13 losses, but he's got so much experience in those losses, going the distance with really, really tough fighters. Now, undersized for a heavyweight, as I said, but you know, kind of around the same weight as far as Francis Ngannou, and then with his ability to slow fights down and make it difficult for his opponents, you know. This is where his size really doesn't, you know, his reach disadvantage really doesn't affect him too much. Now, I've pulled a few clips of some of these guys to show you, and the Derek Chisora ones. The first one I'm going to show you is the dominance of his right hand. Like he's so focused on his right hand. It's everything to him in these punching combinations. He throws his left in there sometimes, but it's more to line his opponent up for the right hand, push him around, frame inside. Look at this frame that he's got. On the far side, you know what I mean? Slowing people down, staying inside, staying tight, but not allowing them to use their power punches. He's very clever with this kind of stuff, as are all the boxers that I've picked out, especially Tyson Fury, of course. But Chisora's got a very effective game on the inside where, you know, against a tired Francis Ngannou, when he starts throwing these big bombs and when he knows that his opponent's hurt and he starts putting the pressure on, when he puts his foot on the gas, which is not straight away, this is the difference, you know. He gets a bit wild, but he knows when to be wild. I mean, his opponent's pretty much out of this fight now. And that right hook is just, it's just disgusting. And what you'll notice as well, like I was talking about with the left hand, he kind of pries and pushes and guides with his left hand. With his right hook, whether it's coming around or up or over, that's the main focus of all of these. So you'll see him a lot of the time using his lead hand to open up the opportunity for his big power shot. Like he's not throwing this with power. You'll see from a different angle in a minute what I'm talking about. But he just pushes that through his guard and it pushes his opponent's head back and it brings his arm forward. So it opens this big space here for this punch to swing into. It's a really clever use of one hand. And often we see this, like Canelo does this. And I mention Canelo a lot on these shows because he's, you know, for me, he's set a precedent for boxing currently. And he does the same thing with his lead hand. He'll tee his opponent up to hit him, or he'll pry through their guard with one hand, or he'll throw it off to one side. Very, very clever use. And if you know you've got power in one particular hand and you can set that power hand up to land over and over again a variety of different ways, look how he's throwing his left hand. Can you see elbows flared? He's just a push. He's just pushing it through your guard because he's already ready with this right hand to come around the side. Pushes through the guard. And look, the right hand's dropping and circling now. He's drawing all of his power. This pectoral muscle, this anterior deltoid, this bicep, it's all being driven, all being contracted at the same time to pull this right hand around. Look at that. You can see the power across his chest there. And as you see his shoulders pivot, as you see him swing this towards, you're realizing that now he's bringing in all of his midsection as well. Like, it's important to recognize the body mechanics and the reason why he can generate so much power. That is scary. And often what he'll do is he'll pry to the body and then come over the top. This is another really clean knockout. Beautiful work. Like he'll jab, he'll push into the body a little bit, and he'll try and get his opponents to react, bring their hands down. Like, he's trying to counter with the lazy left hook here, but leaves himself wide open at the top. And again, he's driving. He's pulling all of his momentum and everything through that punch. I mean, that slow motion is still fast. Let's watch it full speed. Bang. Pfft, scary. Over and over again, he can land this power. Here's another one. Catches him right on the side of the right on the side of the head above his ear. His legs just go. And when you know you've got that shot and you know you can work your way into range and work to the body, look at this. Body work comes back up with the right hook to the head. Sets him up with the left to open him up again for a big right hook. Like, you just don't want to be up against the ropes tired against Derek Chisora. And if you are starting to back up, he's going to start coming in with that lead hand to the body and on over the top. Now, in a boxing match, you know, the first 3 minutes are going to be really interesting against Ngannou. The point when Ngannou starts to slow down, though, is where Derek Chisora takes over. You know, he can fight into the 10th, 11th, 12th round against really, really big punchers and keep himself safe. It'd be an interesting first step into boxing, but I would feel like if he's going to go that route and not take the biggest fish straight away and just throw all of his cards on the table, it makes sense to get a couple of fights and then a Derek Chisora and then move on if he's having some progress. Chisora's a bit of an unnecessary risk for him for not the kind of payday that he would get against the person I'm going to talk about next, who is Tyson Fury. Okay, let's do Tyson Fury. So, first thing that stands out to me is the size of the man. Look at the size of him. 6'9", 85-inch reach. So he's got a 2-inch reach advantage over Francis Ngannou, who has got a massive reach, 83 inches. Like John Jones is 84.5. There's not a great deal of difference in it. You're talking half an inch. But 6'9". See, this is why John Jones is an unusual athlete, because he's 6'4", but he's got 85-inch reach. 6'9", you know, nearly 20 pounds heavier, and with the movement of a cruiserweight, like the way that he's able to bump out of range and create gaps for himself, but also use his size and his frame to lean on his opponents and make them carry his weight. Again, absolute nightmares for someone like Francis Ngannou, who, if he doesn't land one of those nuclear warhead shots, it's going to be a schooling. And something else that I want to discuss as well, of course, is because the Gypsy King has mentioned that he would do like a hybrid rules fight, which, you know, might be something that Jake Paul can broker for the PFL, in a cage, in 4 ounce gloves, Queensbury rules. I would even be interested in backing Tyson Fury in an MMA career if he decided to spend a good 6 months working on takedown defense and clinch work, because, of course, he'd have to, you know, cut down a little bit to get to the 265 limit. But as you see with his superpower, he's got fighting man instincts, and it's something that we can't underestimate. Like, Tyson Fury comes from a lineage of fighters, and fighters that have gone into boxing because they can make money in boxing. But let's make the distinction between boxing and fighting. Like, Tyson Fury is a fighter. His dad, John Fury, is a fighter. The ancestors of Tyson Fury were fighters. Like, there's a craft that's been passed down from one generation to another. And it's not just a craft of boxing. It's a craft of beating another individual up, because being a fighting man in his community is everything. It's, you know, it's paramount. And there's a really good documentary. Check out Board Films. You'll enjoy those little documentaries that he makes. They're really, really, he pulls great clips from all over the place. And there's a clip where Tyson Fury's talking about the importance of being a fighting man. But there's also something that comes with that, and this instinct to be able to read your opponent, which is the thing that stands out to me with Tyson Fury. He's able to look his opponent in the eyes and know how they feel and understand when to lean on them, when to push them, when to move away and give them some space. Very, very intelligent man, and a very smart fighter, and agile for his height and weight. Now, this, of course, would be massive problems for Francis Ngannou. You put him in 4 ounce gloves, you put him in a car park with no gloves on, it doesn't matter. This is a nightmare fight for Francis Ngannou. Tyson Fury can take Undertaker-like shots from Deontay Wilder and just sit up and be like, okay, let's carry on. We don't know what Francis Ngannou's power would look like in boxing gloves. We know what it looks like in 4 ounce gloves, but then you've got to also take into account Tyson Fury's power in 4 ounce gloves and his ability to then grab wrists and hand fight. I mean, you add elbows into that. John Fury's dad has got teeth marks all up and down his forearms from fighting. Like, again, it's, you know, anything that works, elbows, headbutts, whatever. That ability to be able to fight inside is on par, in my opinion, with what John Jones does in MMA. John's very good at rolling things around people's guards and finding his way through. And you put smaller gloves onto Tyson Fury's hands, and he becomes even more dangerous, in my opinion. Some boxers do really well within the rule set of boxing, and when you make it into a fight, they start to struggle. You put boxing gloves on Tyson Fury, and you've limited him, in my opinion. You take gloves off him, he becomes a far more dangerous individual. Not only because of his size and his ability to move and his hand speed, but also because of his processing, his ability to read his opponents and know what's the right thing to do in the fight. Now, the clips I've pulled for Tyson Fury are focused on a few particular things. First of all, in his last fight against Derek Chisora, who, as we know from the last clips, is a big puncher. Knowing when to step in, when to step out, knowing when to put the pressure on him is very smart, but also reading where his opponent's head is. He's not throwing preset combinations, or he's not throwing the punches that he knows are his favourites. He's throwing the weapons which are necessary to hit his opponent as they're moving. Watch what I'm talking about. And again, like leaning and posting and pushing and very, very clever with the way that he uses his other hand, just like Derek Chisora can be with his lead hand, but not nearly as, well, far more complex in regards to Tyson Fury. Like, knows when to step out, knows when to take a minute, take a breather. Derek Chisora's hands are up, stays back against the ropes, and then he moves his way back in. And same thing again, you know, it's just clever work, feints, works to the body a little bit, posts, lovely uppercut. Like, look how that uppercut just rolls up the center line. Really nice. And my favourite one in a second. And this one's really nice. Because, again, he's reading. Look how low Derek Chisora's head is. And he sees him come up the other side, and he reads he's going to come back. So, look, Derek Chisora's going to go. He's on his right side right now. He's going to roll left, stop there, and preset. He's going to roll him back, right? So we've seen that. Double roll, 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 right? Let's have it a second time. You can't get away with it a second time. Roll. See how he adjusts that little hook? It's very clever work. Very smart. Reading where his opponent is, adjusting his weapons for it. There we go. Roll. Adjusts it. Really low, long left hook. Really low. Sees him rolling back, puts the punch exactly where he's going to be rolling into. And the other clip as well, the other hook, the other uppercut that we see from this fight as well, where in the exchange, when you're first watching it, it doesn't really seem like too much is happening. It doesn't really seem like he's landed cleanly, but when you watch how it cuts through his guard, and this is where I say, you know, you put smaller gloves on him, he's able to sneak, 10-ounce gloves through the guard, through that little gap in there. Look at that, that's the gap he's going for. You put him with him 4 ounce gloves where he can start to actually grab wrists as well. It becomes very problematic. And then a lovely lean. And we see this a lot as well, which would be a real problem for Ngannou, who's trying to get his head out of the way. You know, you get a 6'9", 280-pound man leaning on the back of your head like that. You've got to engage your back muscles and deadlift a little bit to keep yourself upright. And look at this, straight through the guard. Really nice. And what we saw in the Deontay Wilder fight was the same thing. So he's going to come in with a big right hand, catch him. This was the third fight. And then he's going to go over the top with his left arm, lean on him, put some weight on him, keeps his posture broken, back of the head, keeps his posture broken, and then watch what he does with this right hand over here. As he moves his left arm from the back of his head, the uppercut comes straight up the center line. clever work with uppercuts. Ideal for a big man like Tyson Fury, who is going to be very overbearing, very imposing for most people. They're going to end up getting underneath. So he has got these lovely rolling uppercuts, works to the body and then comes back up the center line. Exhausting work, very, very clever. A very, very difficult fight for Ngannou in any sense. You know, boxing, MMA, it doesn't really matter. Under any rule set, I think that would be probably the toughest test for Ngannou out there. And if Tyson Fury decided to fight some kind of hybrid rules or even just let's have a go at MMA, you give him 6 months with the right track, with the right coaches and the right training camp, and he's stuffing takedowns and beating you up against the fence, kind of like Jones did against Teixeira. I could see Tyson really gravitating towards elbows. Oh, scary stuff. So, of course, we're going to move on to the scariest power puncher, in my opinion, of the whole sport of boxing, especially now. Of course, you know, people are always going to say Mike Tyson. Yeah, for sure. But Mike Tyson's like 5'10". Like, he's a scary dude. He's a scary dude because you look at him in the eyes. I mean, maybe not quite so much at the moment, but the guy's a scary individual. Deontay Wilder has got that same kind of energy, but the difference is he's 6'7". He's got an 83-inch reach. So even though he draws the same reach as Ngannou, he's got a 3-inch height advantage, and he is so clean with that right hand. That's why his superpower is the Great Eraser. That's the name that he has for his right hand. It's like the times when you see him land it and his opponent falls to the floor and they start convulsing, or they're just like stiff, like they've just fallen into a coffin. It's terrifying. And, you know, you consider this guy's knockout ratio. You know, where are we? 97.67% knockout rate, 20 in the first round. I mean, incredible. 43-2, 42 knockouts. Terrifying individual. Let's take out flight mode for a second, Jamie, and check the Twitter poll. I put a Twitter poll up yesterday. It should be about concluded now. Because I was interested to see what people thought about the comparison of power. And we don't know what Ngannou's power looks like in boxing gloves. And, you know, we could have to ask one of his coaches who's holding pads for him for that. But you've got to wonder how much that would transfer. So here we go. We've got an hour left, so we'll call it there. So 7,707 votes. Thank you for everyone that's voted. 49% Francis Ngannou, 51% Deontay Wilder. Now, of course, my followers are slightly stacked more towards MMA. You've got to keep that in mind. I would imagine if we put this out on somebody else's Twitter who's more heavily into boxing, you would have a very different response. But that just shows you kind of where people think. You know what I mean? Like even if my Twitter is heavily stacked towards MMA, people are still looking at Deontay Wilder and thinking to himself, Francis Ngannou's scary, Deontay Wilder's scary. And another thing you have to consider as well is that Francis Ngannou, they both had a late start. Deontay Wilder was a two-sport athlete at high school. I think he dropped out to start looking after his daughter and got into boxing to try and make some money pretty quick. Started boxing at 20, ended up with a bronze medal at the Olympics. You know, just it turned out that this was... You know, I mean, he could have really done anything, I would imagine. He's a very, very talented athlete. And because he's played two other sports before he got into boxing, he's got that physical awareness, that competitive edge as well, where he knows how to get himself up for competition. I feel like he's going to be far more composed in circumstances where Ngannou might feel a bit uncomfortable. And something else you have to remember as well is if you took Francis Ngannou at 20 years old and you put him into boxing purely... That power might be comparable with Deontay Wilder as far as Ngannou's boxing career, but because Ngannou went in the MMA direction, he's spread his credits across several different ranges. You know, he's now got to learn wrestling and sub defense, etc. So we don't really know what Francis Ngannou would have looked like if he'd have taken the same path as Deontay Wilder. Would he have been the same kind of knockout puncher as Wilder? Because that, I mean, you know. Almost everybody falls at his feet at some point in the fight. Even the people that make it the distance with him, even Fury, they fall at his feet at some point. he's a scary dude. He's a scary dude. And I'm not going to focus on anything in particular in this one, although what I do want you to pay attention to in this little playlist that I put together of all my favourite right-hand knockouts is the difference in them. Some of them are very, very close range moving forward. Some of them he starts at a distance, moves forward and uses that long reach. Sometimes, like his last fight against Hellenius, he's backing up and he's using his jab and his footwork, and Hellenius comes crashing forward onto a like a Shane Carwin, like a, you know, 12-inch punch. There's not really much movement in it. Just a terrifying individual. Someone that could have quite easily used this physical power that he's got to transfer into anything. He just happened to transfer it into boxing and it became the Great Eraser. I mean, like that's the position that people end up on the floor. They just spread out. This guy is shaking and scary, scary power. Like, it doesn't even look like he touches them sometimes. And that's a sign of a big puncher. Like, a lot of the time you see Ngannou hit somebody and you're like, yeah, okay. Like, it makes sense why that knocked him out. It's because he dug it from the core of the earth. You know, like the Overeem knockout, turned him into the Pez man. It was ridiculous. But you watch the punch and you're like, well, yeah, of course it's going to be powerful because he's an intense, powerful individual and he's digging it from the canvas. Like Deontay Wilder, just like, and Shane Carwin is the other one that comes to mind. Watch, this is an old MMA fight for you. Shane Carwin, Gabriel Gonzaga. It was like, and Gabriel Gonzaga just folded up like a deck chair. Yeah, it's the same kind of power that Deontay Wilder's got. You can be at the end of his reach if you want, and he's still going to hit you, but it's not going to make a difference. If you're 2 feet closer to him, he's still going to hit you with the same kind of power. Power is here, 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 all the way to the end of his reach, which is a scary thing, scary thing. And because it's so direct as well, you know, you've got to think if he's fighting someone like Ngannou who does swing and he does get a little bit excitable, that's going to cut straight through the center of your guard, put you on the floor. And look at this, this is his last fight against Hellenius, backing up against the ropes, wide guard, and sees his opportunity. Look, his opponent is flying forward. You can picture Ngannou in these positions where he's lunging in with big power shots. And here he comes, right down the center line, right on the nose. I mean, at least he got to close his eyes before it landed, I suppose. But then as he fell, his eyes were open. And when he hit the canvas, his eyes were open as well. Scary. Look how direct it is. Look how short it is as he throws it. I mean, this is the danger if Ngannou takes on someone that's got the same similar kind of punching power that he's got with Deontay Wilder, but also has got, you know, he's taken all of his combat sports education credits and stacked them all into boxing, and has not spent any time doing wrestling or jiu-jitsu or, you know, any of that. He's been very, very specific. So that little edge that he's got with the more directness of his punches, coupled with the height advantage and with the confidence in 98% knockout ratio, again, a very, very scary individual. And someone who, you know, take boxing gloves off and stick MMA gloves on, and I could make this whole show about him with all of these opponents, and I'd still fancy his chances against a lot of them, you know? He's pretty impressive athlete, pretty impressive power puncher, and very, very direct with that right hand, which makes him very, very dangerous against someone like Ngannou, who does tend to wing a little bit. Okay. Right, let's get into some MMA. And I'm gonna do a brief mention of Ryan Bader. I'm not going to dwell on it too much because of all the MMA fights, this is the least likely. Bellator may like the idea of it, but Ryan Bader's not going to want this fight, honestly. This is the kryptonite for Ryan Bader. Someone who is confident and powerful that doesn't give any respect to his striking or his wrestling. That's his kryptonite. Like the fight that always sticks out in my mind is when he fought Anthony Johnson, and Johnson had him mounted, and Bader's hanging onto a kimura, and not hanging onto a kimura like there's a possibility I'm going to finish this. Like hanging onto a kimura like if I've got one of his arms, he's not going to be able to punch me with it. Like scared, terrified of the man. And it would be even more intense, I would imagine, with Ngannou, who, of course, I mean, you know, Anthony Johnson, we all love him and we miss him. Ngannou's a bigger dude, just a bigger, more powerful individual, I would say. And we know his wrestling's coming on. So even if he's able to stuff a couple of takedowns, like the panic that would set in for Bader. And again, you know, he's not massive as far as heavyweight goes. You know, he's got more of a heavyweight upper body than a lower body, 6'2" compared to 6'4". So he's given up height and, you know, a lot of reach. I can't imagine this fight happening. And if it did, I think Bader would have lost it before the fight even started. You know, he would be a different kind of animal that he'd be facing. And I don't know as Bader would. He would have the confidence to be able to finish takedowns and win the fight minute by minute. I feel like he would get into the fight with at some point expecting to be cracked with one of those massive punches and hand the belt over. So I'm not going to dwell on this one too much, but we'll see. You know, the world might prove me wrong. It constantly does. Okay, before we go any further, this show is brought to you by Factor 75, an awesome meal prep company. Now, of course, we've all got New Year's resolutions. We all want to get in better shape, lose a bit of weight, improve our diet and nutrition. These guys are going to take it all off your plate, going to make it very, very easy for you. Factor75.com. Get on there and check out. They've got 34 meals each week. They've got 36 snacks and juices and a variety of other things. We've got Veronica's sister into this recently, and she's regularly sending us photos of these meals that she's preparing for herself. And all the juices and snacks, of course, makes it easier when she's working. You know, of course, we've all got, you know, high-paced lifestyles, lots of different things we have to worry about. Making your meal times much more straightforward is a benefit to everybody. And Factor 75 have got you covered. So if you go to factor75.com/outlawed60, outlawed60, that'll get you 60% off your first box. And I mean, just take a look. Have a look at the stuff on there. Vegan, vegetarian, keto options, all different kinds of stuff. Whatever your diet and your nutritional choices and requirements are, Factor 75 will have you covered. So Outlawed60 is the code. Make sure you check it out. Factor75.com/outlawed60. Anatoly Malkin, light heavyweight and heavyweight champion of ONE Championship. Now, again, undersized for a heavyweight. Still, you know, I mean, longer reach than some of the heavyweights that we've talked about. 78 inches compared to 83. So he's still got a disadvantage, but it's not as great as say, Bader's. 5'11", not particularly tall. But this is something that doesn't necessarily work against him, because you look at most of his opponents and they all look, you know, 50, 60 pounds bigger, 5 inches taller. He doesn't seem to make a difference. He has this pace, and it might be partly due to the fact that he trains out at Tiger Muay Thai with Peter Yan and a bunch of others that are lightweight, fast-paced, work hard, you know, push, push, push. Because the way that he fights, it's not like heavyweight in a lot of ways. Like, he's very kind of springy and stepping through with different stances and winging over the top. And because he's got that wrestling base, he always feels like it's going to be his opponent that's going to initiate wrestling first if he puts enough pressure on. And when they do, he's front headlock, snap them down, circle to their back. And then he's in that side turtle position, just smacking him in the side of the head. Now, 12-0 undefeated, he's still very early in his career, and if we double this pro career, if we put him at 24 fights with no losses, and he's been, you know, he's had the right challenges as he's moved along, you know, he certainly has the potential to you know, be one of the best heavyweights on the planet. I just feel like right now it's a little bit early to put him in that conversation, and I think it's a bit early to think that in a fight with Ngannou he's going to be able to land the same kind of shots that he's going to be able to take. But again, you know, with a bit more experience, I mean, what he did to Derrida in his last fight, you know, and of course, Derrida's a very, very strong jiu-jitsu player. So Malkin was almost his kryptonite in the fact that he could stop him doing jiu-jitsu and hit him really hard as well. Ngannou kind of plays a similar game, but doesn't have the same kind of movement as Malkin. So it would be very much a fast-paced, in-and-out kind of fight, like Volkanovski, like all over him, you know, using his speed and his conditioning against him, and always knowing that he's got the backup of trying to make Ngannou wrestle, even if he's not physically able to you know, to control him. I mean, you know, this, the other thing you have to consider is, so he's 5'11", but he's also, you know, his last weigh-in was 225 pounds because he fought for the ONE Championship light heavyweight belt. So, of course, you know, he's going to be maybe, you know, 15, 20 pounds heavier than that, but most likely it's not going to be great weight. It's not going to be, he's not going to be a very physically imposing person. So he would have to use pace to you know, to overcome. I mean, you know, we'll look at a couple of clips because he's a very fun fighter to watch, and do get a chance to watch his fight against the Ritter if you haven't seen it already. But I like the way that he uses this right hand, and he does vary the target. He will come to the body, but look at that counter over the top. It's beautiful. See what I mean about the size difference between him and his opponents? But a little dip to the side. Like using that speed advantage, knowing his opponents are going to be slower and easier to get out of the way. So he relies far more on his head movement than most would at heavyweight. Really good takedown offense look. Hammer fists underneath. He's just a problematic fighter for anyone to deal with. And I think within the next few years, if he keeps on with the same trajectory, we're going to be thinking about, okay, who do we need to see him fight now to really see where he's at as far as the heavyweight elite go? Because he's a scary dude, and he's a firecracker. A lot of fun to watch. And like I said, you know, 12-0 into his career, he's very much in the beginning. Look at that lovely step through. I've broken this down before on the channel when I was talking about his fight against the Ritter. Throws the right hand, springs off his back foot, lands on his front foot, and then leaps with a gazelle punch with the same hand. Like, he's in the air as he's landing that. Proper Super Mario stuff. You know, he's able to use his speed and his power to his advantage in against all of these opponents. But of course, you know, we need to see him move up and fight the real elites, and Ngannou would be that. But certainly an interesting one to keep in mind. What didn't I say about him? Educated Mauler. Oh, I didn't mention the subs. So Bader's got three subs, guillotine, arm triangle, rear naked choke. His last sub was 2013 against Vladimir Matyushenko. I think he's got his bus pass by now. That's a joke for the UK listeners. Anatoly Malkin, four submissions, two key locks, a triangle and a rear naked choke. Just an interesting one to keep an eye on. Certainly has the potential to cause real problems at heavyweight, and not to be underestimated because of his height. Because, you know, you've got to think Daniel Cormier, champ, he's about 5'11", 5'10", 5'11". You know, even you go back a bit further and you think of someone like Igor Vovchanchin, one of my favourites, Enson Inoue, some absolute monsters that have been fighting at heavyweight that are not necessarily heavyweight size. Doesn't mean that it can't be effective. Okay, let's move on to Antti Delia, winner of the PFL 2022 championships. Good experience in MMA, 23 wins, 5 losses, 11 knockouts, 6 submissions, slight height advantage, 1 inch, slight reach disadvantage, but he stands very, very close to his opponent. So that works one or two ways. It nullifies that reach advantage, puts pressure on whoever he's fighting to throw first, because he generally waits for them to go so he can counter. But it does put him in punching range. I mean, you'll notice that there's, like, in this photo, there's like a bit of scar tissue and damage on his face. You can tell he's had a couple of scraps. But his superpower, he is Krokop's avatar, and we can't forget how useful that is, because for me, like, Krokop was an anomaly in MMA striking. Like, there were lots of different really nice little tricks that Krokop used, especially because everyone knew that he was going to kick him in the head with his left foot. I mean, that was like, oh, we're fighting Krokop. Head kicks. Yeah, head kicks. But what are you going to do about it? Because he knows how to land them. He knows how to set you up so you start thinking about something else. It is amazing when people are able to use the same skill over and over again and their opponent expects it. And Delia's got, he kind of cuts through the nonsense. He's a very adaptable striker. He's got fast hands. He's very accurate. But he kind of cuts through the nonsense of MMA. He doesn't waste his time, it seems to me, like trying to show you he can do everything. Like, he knows this is what works. He knows that he's a good boxer. He's got fast hands. If he cracks you with a few shots, you're either going to get knocked down or he's going to level change and take you down against the fence. And once you're down, he's going to beat you up against the fence and make you either panic, get the referee to stop it, or you're going to turn and give you his back, and then he's rear naked choke. So has he got 4 out of 6 submissions? North-south choke and a guillotine. Another person we can't underestimate, and someone that I feel like, although he takes risks in the way that he stands, you know, if he's able to get through those first few shots with good defence, then he's able to start finding his pockets to land. I pulled a couple of clips of Delia to show you. One was his last fight, his rematch against Mateusz Scheffel. And you'll see what I mean. He's like, he's very, very good at standing close into range and kind of tempting you to go first so he can hit you with counters because he's faster and more accurate most of the time. Like staying in the pocket with confidence, with good defence. Bang, bang. Nice left hook counter there. Like, look how he splits that. Throws the jab. Sees the right hand coming over the top. Throws the right hand of his own down the side and comes back with the left hook. Rocks Scheffel, pushes him back against the fence, and then the blitz. Fast hands, drops him against the fence, and like I said, the referee could stop it. Or like we saw against Vejeda, he just stays in top position. He has like this loose top control where he keeps weight on them, keeps pressuring them into the fence, but doesn't really commit to grappling as such. Like look at the positioning of his legs and his knees here. Like he's controlling this top leg here by pushing it down with the instep of his left foot. So he's not any use to Vejeda. If he starts to push into that leg, he's gonna end up turning and giving his back anyway, just out of pressure. And then we look at what he's doing with his other leg, which is here, and he's got that foot pinned to the floor. So that the other leg of Fajeda's not going anywhere. It's almost like he's forcing him to give him his back. You can also see he's got that little post on the backside as well where his hand is. So he's got a couple of different wedges to stop Fajeda moving back towards him. Really clever positioning, whilst at the same time having what seems to be quite like aggressive, like, I'm going to try and murder you ground and pound. He's still thinking about what he's doing with his lower body, like leaving himself options. Like, look, he's got this leg in here. In case Vejeda turns away, then he's already got that near side hook in. Someone else that is definitely worth keeping an eye on. And of course, he's going to be back in the PFL in the new year, probably trying to defend his championship in the 2023 season. And who knows, we might see Ngannou in there as well. That would be very nice. I feel like of all the MMA guys outside of the UFC, Delia is the one that I would like to see Ngannou fight the most. The only downside is that he doesn't have that name to really draw the big eyes on pay-per-views. But, you know, Ngannou may be the person to do that on his own. We'll see. But certainly Anthony Delia has got, he's got a lot of skills that could... He could potentially push Ngannou back if he starts to fatigue again. You know, we always talk about this with Ngannou. It's about covering the big power shots and forcing him to work at a consistent pace where he struggles to recover. I mean, we've seen his conditioning get better. We've seen the evolution in his wrestling, in his grappling. But against someone with better resistance with their wrestling, with their grappling, you know, does that range now start to become problematic for him? Because Cyril didn't have the game to really contend. John Jones, although he's undersized for the weight class, which is the next person we're going to go into, John Jones, although he might be undersized as far as weight for heavyweight, he's got the technical abilities like Anthony Delia to use his lower body to be able to pin and control as he's ground and pounding. Doesn't necessarily have to use all of his weight and his strength when you can use position, wrist control, pinning the legs to the canvas and those kind of things. This is where John Jones, of course, is again like a fascinating opponent. We've been waiting for him to move up to heavyweight, and you look at the comparison, both 6'4", John Jones with an inch and a half reach advantage, 26 wins on his record, one disqualification for downward elbows, which shouldn't really be legal anyway. 10 knockouts, 6 submissions, and you'll remember that Lyoto Machida choke you out, drop you against the fence. There's a meanness to John Jones, and I know, you know, and I don't mean to say this. I'm not being in any way kind of, I'm not in any way being disrespectful when I say this, but there's a mean streak to John Jones that you see when he's fighting, and when he's doing his interviews, he hides it. You know, like he's kind of, oh, I'm, you know, friendly, et cetera, but when you put somebody in front of him, they are food. Right, he is trying to rip you apart and take bites out of you. And that edge is really what makes John Jones great in mixed martial arts, because he finds the edges of the rule book where he can push and really try and do damage to you with nasty things. like, of course, the oblique kicks, which, you know, some people are very much on the fence about whether they should be legal or not. My opinion is, of course, they absolutely should be. It's combat sports, you know. It's very rare. I mean, we saw that one. Was it? It was Khalil Rountree, wasn't it, against Modestus, where he basically stomped through his knee, but he was fine. You know, he did nothing wrong with his knee. It's very, very difficult to do a lot of damage to someone's knee. I would imagine if you looked at the statistics for oblique kicks compared to heel hooks, most people would want to ban heel hooks as well. And people will say, ah, yeah, but you get the opportunity to tap. Depends who's got a hold of your leg, let's be honest. If it's Husamar Power-Harris, he ain't waiting for you to tap. There's a lot of people that will keep twisting that even after the referee's trying to get them off. So let's not mistake this for what it is. This is prize fighting. These guys are trying to hurt one another. And John Jones is always right at the forefront of what can I do? What can I use against you, which you're not going to think about? And like, there are little things that he does. Like when he fought Gustafsson the second time, there was a moment, I'm sure it was the first round, where they locked up and he had like a loose overhook on Gustafsson's arm, at Gustafsson's right arm, and he wrenched the elbow inwards. And that's not, like, he's not looking for a submission. He's not like, oh, I've got him in a shoulder lock. No, he's trying to, like, think of what it looks like when you take a chicken and you pull it apart. Like, that's what John Jones is trying to do to his shoulder in a second. That meanness, that like clawing, posting on the face, and the you know, it's everything is that little edge that John Jones gets because you feel like you're being bullied and pushed around. Like the things that stood out about John Jones's game. Well, let's first of all look at the very opening of his last fight, because we see exactly what we would see against Ngannou, in my opinion. If Ngannou's aggressive coming forward, we're going to see Jones level change and body lock and try and wrestle him and force him to work and try and discourage him from moving forward with speed. If he's backing up, we're going to see John Jones kind of stalking and switching his stance and stomping at that lead leg and just trying to do as much damage from the outside as possible without overcommitting. Like, of course, you know, we've had a few decisions with John Jones where people will complain about his work rate, but you're not the one standing in front of these killers. You know, like, you look at the Dom Reyes and the Thiago Santoses and the, you know, the Ovince St. Preux, you know full well that if they crack you with a shot, they're gonna put you out. You have to take what John Jones does against the opponents that he does it and appreciate how easy it makes it look most of the time. And this vindictiveness is something that I feel like is a surprise to a lot of people. I feel like it kind of comes as a shock when it's like, you know, touch gloves and respect and et cetera, but then when you start fighting, you feel this kind of, this vindictiveness come out of his game. Like the, you know, dropping Lyoto Machida up against the fence, it just shows you kind of where he's at. He's a dominant world champion, and I wouldn't expect anything less from him. Like, this is what, and people mistake this because I talk about Peter Yan in this regard as well. I don't believe that Peter Yan didn't think that he was gonna get told off for kneeing Aljamain Sterling in the head. I feel like he kind of lost his patience with the way that Sterling was fighting and felt like he was going to do it anyway. Because I've watched enough Peter Yan to know that when he gets frustrated, he starts headbutting you and stuff. I've noticed champions in the UFC, champs in the UFC, that leave their fingers and their thumbs out when they're punching to get away with the eye pokes. This is combat sports, yes, and we all want it to be nice and clean and polite and everyone shake hands and embraces afterwards. But you've got to remember, when that timer is ticking and the round is going, it is war. And if you are not in that mentality where you're do or die, you're already at a disadvantage. And John Jones brings that advantage every time he comes in, because he is willing to do whatever damage necessary to you and to leave the fans with whatever sick feeling that he's just wrenched your shoulder apart or he's just elbowed your face to pieces. He just doesn't care. He's there to do a number on you, as we would say in the UK. Oh, is that a transferable saying, do you reckon, Jamie? Do a number on them? It's a bit of an odd thing to say. I'm sure people will read into that in another way, and I don't mean it that way, of course. He's just the same way that I feel like Tyson Fury would adapt to MMA. Jamie's still laughing. The same way that Tyson Fury, I feel, would adapt to MMA, he is the same kind of things that we see from John Jones. And I'll be honest, I mean, maybe I'm overestimating Fury in some ways, but I feel like Fury might be even more mean if he can get away with it in MMA gloves. But there's just something that we don't see. There's a characteristic that, and you know, of course, I've enjoyed Bader's fights over the years. We kind of moved past him quite quickly, but it's because I've seen him break mentally in fights, and I've seen John Jones rally in really bad situations, like that spinning elbow that he landed on Gustafsson. Like honestly, like I could hear the spine, the vertebrae in his spine clink together as he went down his spine like dominoes. Like, ugh, not a nice feeling. Not even to watch is not a nice thing. Like, that's the thing. Like, you watch these, like, oh, let me just slow it down so we can really appreciate. So level change, drives in, comes up with a knee. Oh, no, sorry, there's the knee. Nice movement there from Dominic Reyes. But look straight away what he goes to. Hard kick to the back leg. Bang. Straight away out. And he's going to do the same thing to the front leg. Look at that hyperextension. Like, if you're Francis Ngannou and you rely on that lead leg to plant for forward movement, imagine Ngannou taking four or five of those to the lead leg and then trying to throw the uppercut that he knocked out Alistair Overeem with. I still think he'd do a lot of damage, of course, but that leg might not be able to support that drive of that power to go down through it. Because wherever power goes through a punch, you've got to anticipate that power, that recoil going back down the same path. And if this is why it's important to have your back foot planted on when you throw in a straight right, is it's like a lightning conductor, right? It's where the power, the recoil is earthed. If I don't have a secure frame, then I'm going to struggle to generate the same kind of power. And this is enough to, within a couple of shots, to really do a lot of damage to a lead leg. Not, and again, you know, we don't want to overestimate. We're not saying permanent damage necessarily, because a lot of it's not permanent damage. You know, hyperextensions and strains and stuff. There, you know, just is a jump oblique kick there, like over and over again. And look at the reaction that it starts to get. Like, look at Glover reaching for it. And I went back and watched this fight. I mean, I've been a couple of years since I watched it. Make no mistake, John Jones would decimate the light heavyweight division right now. We just can't underestimate that. I look at the light heavyweight division in the UFC. I'm like, if I'm Alex Pereira, I'm staying at middleweight while John Jones is a light heavyweight. John Jones gone. I'm Alex Pereira. I'm like, I'm calling out everybody. Like, there's great fighters in the light heavyweight division. Don't get me wrong, but not with the same comparison that you can have with John Jones. And John Jones moving up to heavyweight, of course, there's a lot of questions. We don't know what he's going to weigh in at. We don't know physically how he's going to perform with that kind of size, muscle mass on his body. We've got to expect him to be bigger, but how much bigger? Is he going to be 230, 240, 250? There's going to be a point of diminishing returns where his weight advantage over his opponents is going to be a disadvantage for his cardio. Like, Jones is not naturally a heavily muscled guy. Like, if you look at the breakdown of people, you've got ectomorphs, endomorphs, and mesomorphs, and John Jones is somewhere between an ectomorph and a mesomorph. He's right on the edge of being long and skinny because he's long arms and long legs. He doesn't carry a lot of muscle on them, which is why he was able to have such massive physical attributes at light heavyweight. I feel like if he's able to gain enough muscle to make him impactful at heavyweight and strong enough at heavyweight, then he's just going to be just as dangerous. But definitely, he needs to find that limit where that weight gain is a disadvantage to him. Because of course, you know, John's not going to be fighting 15-minute fights. They're all going to be championships or main events. So they're all going to be 25 minutes. And he needs to understand how this new machine that he's driving is going to work over 25 minutes. Now, again, you know, because he controls most fights and because Ngannou is going to be the one with the, you know, the perceived limitations for his cardiovascular system if they ever fought, John might be able to control it at a pace where Ngannou kind of feels shut out a lot of the time. Can't really feel like he can get inside. Keeps hitting that oblique kick to the leg and Ngannou struggling to move forward. When he does move forward, Jones level changes and forces him to defend takedowns. And then you're in the clinch against John Jones and he's kneeing you and he's elbowing you. And the hand play that he has is really fantastic as well. Like, the reason I went back to this fight is because he really did a lot of damage to Glover Teixeira right on the inside. Dig into the body, uppercuts up the center line into the chin, and then controlling wrists. Like, you can see what he's doing here. We can't really see it very well, but that's John Jones's hand there controlling the wrist of Glover Teixeira. And a lot of the time, what you'll notice in this fight, and he did the same against Rashad Evans as well, kept locking horns, as he calls it. He's grabbing and he's controlling wrists and he's stuffing hands. But what that does is it not only removes your guard and nullifies this arm, but it opens you up. Like, you can't bring this elbow up to stop him cracking you as he rolls his arm over the top. I used to use this a lot in guard. It worked really well for, you know, from ground and pound from guard, but John Jones uses it standing up against the fence really well. Like, you can see this wrist control he's got here. It's constant. Anything he can do to disrupt. And if you're Ngannou and you're starting to get tired and you've got Jones leaning on you and controlling wrists and hanging on your head and then stepping away and cracking you with body shots and uppercuts and elbows, it would be exhausting. There's that. Look at that. So he's got that wrist control there, look. He's stuffing the hand into Glover Teixeira's center line. And then he's going to roll this elbow around and crack him, dropping his wrist down to bring his elbow up. Lovely transition. Bang. It's a shame we get it on the camera angle change, really. I think I grabbed a replay of it, though. Like, just solid work on the inside. Exhausting to be dealing with this. And then, you know, every now and then you're going to get hit with something that's going to rock you or hurt you to the body or cut you potentially. There it is. Look, here we go. Wrist control, look. Opens up this target on the side of his head so he can roll this elbow around and crack him with no guard. Lovely work. Something that the heavyweight division don't really see at the moment, this kind of stuff, which is why John Jones stepping into the heavyweight division is going to be very interesting. I think he can throw a lot of things on the table that would make most heavyweights just confused, unsure of what's going on, unsure why they keep getting hit with these same shots over and over again. You know, and because of the well-roundedness of John Jones' game, the only real question when it comes to heavyweight is how he transfers from light heavyweight to heavyweight with the weight. Like, what does his body look like at that weight class? How does he deal with, you know, potentially five rounds with someone like Cyril Gane, which of course I'll do a show on to break it down. But, you know, five rounds with Cyril Gane, who doesn't move like a heavyweight, but definitely is the same size as a heavyweight. You know, he's like, even if John Jones is winning those wrestling exchanges like he potentially would against Ngannou, he's still a much, much bigger person to be moving around. You know, still a much bigger person to keep breaking down and controlling. It's a massive effort to control someone that's bigger and more powerful than you. And you know, we don't know how John Jones would transfer to this weight class, which is why someone that's a more familiar heavyweight like Ngannou might be able to just keep hustling up back to the feet and keep being threatening enough to edge ahead on the scorecards. It's a fascinating one. And I think, of course, of all the fights in mixed martial arts, Jones against Ngannou is the one we all want to see, and most likely the one of all the ones that I've talked about, which is the least likely to happen at this point. But the world is a very interesting place and things can come around. That wouldn't surprise me if we see Jones Ngannou at some point in the next couple of years, especially if Ngannou is rewarded for the risk that he's taken stepping out of his contract and vacating the belt. Like, if he goes in there and fights Derek Chisora and looks great and catches him, and then he, say, steps into a super fight against Tyson Fury, you know, his market value might increase to the point that even if he loses in those fights, it would still be the fight that people would want to see is him coming back into the UFC to fight John Jones. And that's all dependent on whether John Jones is able to beat Francis Ngannou, which we can't consider to be a foregone conclusion, because it's not. Again, questions around John Jones as a heavyweight more than anything. Not about his meanness or his skill set or his anything. Just, what does he look like at heavyweight? Because we know what these guys look like and they're all formidable. All right. Well, in the comments, leave any other suggestions you've got. If I can find another five or six people that might be potential opponents that would be interesting, I'll do another one of these shows. But these were the ones that off the top of my head I thought were the most interesting. Of course, you know, Chisora has already asked for it. Tyson Fury's asked for it and offered it in a hybrid rules fight. Deontay Wilder, just for the battle of the power punchers, who's, you know, 51 and 49% on the Twitter poll. Ryan Bader, I just think he would just lose the fight before it even started. Malakin would have a damn good go, but he might be a bit undersized and inexperienced at this point. Antedelia leaves himself right in range, but he's got fast hands and he's very accurate. He might be able to land with counters and then level change and keep it enough of an MMA fight. Probably the most interesting fight outside of the UFC for me is him against Dallaia. And then John Jones back in the UFC. I mean, of course, I'm leaning towards John Jones because of his technical abilities, but that's why Ngannou's so exciting, isn't it? It's because he's got that that fight-ending power. All right. I was going to say enjoy the fights, but enjoy whatever fight turns up to be Ngannou's next. I'm sure it'll be interesting, and I'll see you next time.